This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Room 101, the concept of dystopian hell.
Ah, dystopia.
I'm actually a big fan of dystopian fiction.
Although you are.
I've read a lot less of it recently.
I've never been a fan of dystopian fiction, possibly due to my own general paranoia and my own preference for happy endings, which dystopia doesn't very often give.
No, I think that's fair. Certainly if you look at some of the heavy hitter classics that we will go through later. Yeah, they don't tend to have happy endings. The whole point of them being that they're trying to make you think. They're almost trying to instill a certain amount of fear in the future for you.
Yeah, they are. And these are pieces which are very often reflective of society and the tones and the general mood of society and what we're afraid of. Which is why the shape of dystopia changes, but dystopia itself doesn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And obviously there's been a large upsurgence, largely due, I think, probably to the Hunger Games and things like Divergent, which have, in some ways, I mean, those two in particular weren't lighter, but they've been... There's a lot of ones like Blood Red Road and The Poison Princess and things like that, which are actually lighter, and it's more a case of, this is really a romance set in a dystopian future. Or a post-apocalyptic future.
And I think maybe in that sense, these are dystopias which basically say it's appropriate that you're finding dystopias like that in this age, because it's actually a lot of the really, really hard-hitting dystopias that you used to find were during times of relative peace or relative prosperity. You might want to correct me on that. They were also during times of, you know, Cold War and etc. But I think that many of the modern dystopias have this kind of other theme, which is that there is hope among the despair.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Obviously dystopian fiction in particular is a reflection of the time it's written in.
Yeah. And another thing is that it's the audience in which it's aimed toward, which is that all this, you know, this dystopia that you were just talking about, so Hunger Games, Divergent, it's aimed at young adults, which, again, that's a very hopeful message, because it's there, like, the answer lies with the youth.
Yes.
You are the answer to the problems that we are currently facing.
Yes, it's nearly always a case of the young will rise up and overthrow the jaded old system.
Yeah. Basically. Whereas when you look at sort of dystopia which is aimed toward adults, it doesn't tend to end well.
No, although a lot of them are being repackaged and sold as young adult fiction now. I mean, The Handmaid's Tale is being sold as young adult fiction. In my opinion, that's not young adult fiction. I'm not saying that young adults can't read it, but I wouldn't have said that was ever aimed at young adults.
No, I would tend to agree, though I haven't actually read The Handmaid's Tale, simply because I, as I said, I am not a big fan of dystopia.
Well, let's start off with The Handmaid's Tale, and then there's obviously a series coming out soon on HBO, I think it is.
Goodness me, they get around.
Which will be worth watching, I imagine, because I think Margaret Atwood has actually helped write the script for it. I mean, there's been films and things. But the film ended on a bit of a, I don't know, it was a flat note in my opinion. But The Handmaid's Tale is set in a future America whereby the most viable commodity is a set of working ovaries. There's been some sort of virus that has literally destroyed fertility across North America. So women who have ovaries, you know, they haven't had tubal ligation, or they, you know, they haven't ruined their fertility by taking the pill a lot. For years and years, that is the most tradable commodity because the species is trying to survive. The way it's set up is this horrific sort of proto-Christian patriarchal society whereby women are traded back and forth like goods, and women with viable ovaries become handmaids. They're not even given their own names. They become of Fred or of George or whatever. because they belong to the man in charge who's of whatever district, who literally they become property. The twist is that they're not really property of the husbands, the ones who, you know, climbed the ladder high enough to say that, you know what, you can breed.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually property of the wives of those husbands. And, you know, it is a sex scene, because obviously they're trying to breed with these women who've still got viable ovaries. But you've got the wife there in the bed, and the handmaid's lying between the wife's legs on her back, with the wife holding onto her arms, while the husband does the thing. It's like any good aspect of sex or procreation is taken right out of the equation right there.
Christ.
And the punishments for women who go against being handmaids or whatever are utterly horrific. I mean, it starts off with they're in a sort of training college for them, where they're literally denied writing, they're denied reading, they're denied anything like that. They go on special diets for women who want to become pregnant. Everything is controlled about them. And those who try to rebel are viciously beaten. And if you like, it's organised rape across the entire system, because very few of them would actually choose any of this.
No.
A lot of them have had their children taken away, for example, the ones they had before the disaster, and their children are put into the system as well. The boys tend to get trained up separately as, you know, soldiers and enforcers, and the girls, particularly if they look like they're going to be viable, are then given to the soldiers who actually distinguish themselves enough. And I remember reading it, I think I was 16, and it was horrific and fascinating at the same time. And even at the time, I remember thinking, this is something that could actually happen. And then we've got now, where the sort of people we've got in charge, who are so callous and so removed from, you know, the general day-to-day plight of people, we're taking a step back in human rights in a lot of ways, or we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an argument to say that that book has now suddenly become very relevant, and that might be why it's now climbing the charts again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it goes without saying that very suddenly you're getting a... I mean, sales for 1984.
Yeah.
It's 1984?
Yeah.
Boomed after something was directly quoted from it, I believe, by a prominent person in power. Or, no, it wasn't a direct quote. It was just, it just seemed like it could have been directly from the book, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's the alternative facts comment. And yeah, dystopia, it's weird because dystopia is sort of occupying an odd place in the market currently, whereby it's sort of booming in sales, and yet kind of people are also a little bit more afraid of it now, I think. It's booming in sales, but I don't necessarily think publishers are buying it right now.
No, publishers aren't really buying dystopian fiction in the same way. It's quite a hard sell at the moment.
Yeah.
But I think there's two lines of thought, really, isn't there, for people who are readers? And one is, I want to immerse myself in it because I want to know the worst that can happen, and thereby that gives me a sense of control. Or I want to read something else because actually this is seeming a lot too plausible. And whereas before, in a time of implied threat, it was a bit of a thrill, or when things were a bit more peaceful, it was a bit of a thrill. Now it's actually quite threatening.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I tend to agree with you, is that a lot of the dystopia now is sort of starting to hit a little bit too hard.
Yeah.
So what is it about dystopia that sort of attracts you as a reader, Jules?
I couldn't entirely put my finger on it. I think in some ways it's the same sort of thing that people who are big fans of, like, Lovecraftian fiction, that's what really gets them. They like bleak. I think I like a particular type of bleak, which means I like a future where everything has been completely sort of etch-a-sketched. And, you know, when you do the etch-a-sketch and you shake it to get rid of the picture.
Yeah.
That's the society of the future. Someone has taken the etch-a-sketch and really shaken it hard, and nobody knows where they stand anymore. While that uncertainty is terrifying, it's also full of possibility. So I think that's probably what appeals to me. And in a way, I'm one of those people who I sort of need to have something to fight against. I thrive on a crisis.
Well, you don't have to look far.
No.
Interestingly, the form that dystopia takes, you know, as we mentioned, dystopia is very reflective of the society that it's born from. And sort of looking at modern dystopia, I think possibly one of the sort of the first real examples is Battle Royale, and the way that Battle Royale was kind of conceived, in that it was a game show.
Yeah.
But it was a violent game show. And you know, obviously it's originally Japanese, and Japanese television is hilarious. And also, like, they go to a length that you wouldn't tend to see in Europe, I don't think.
No, they certainly, I mean, you've only got to look at their manga to say, well, they pull no punches there, do they?
Yeah, they don't. But I like that. There's like there's stuff they do in Japanese television that just would never get past it because of just health and safety. Like, no, we can't possibly do that. The this X, Y, and Z could happen, you know. Whereas they're there, like doing all sorts of stuff,
Went to
which is just
Keshi's castle.
which is really potentially very dangerous. And they have a lot of fun with it as well. But regardless, you know, it's quite. That they kind of push the limits a little bit in ways that we wouldn't. So the whole battle royale thing is almost conceivable. And as a manga, it's incredibly violent, incredibly violent. But the conception behind it is that it was a violent society, so they create that. Well, rather not a violent society. Sort of to combat violent youth, they basically just put youths into this scenario, and it's kind of meant to calm everything down. But it's filmed, and they're made to fight, and they're made to kill each other, and the person who wins kind of actually, I believe they get a prize as well, you know. And it's not just that they get to survive, they get a prize.
And so, are you talking about the book or the film?
I'm talking about the manga.
Oh, what, of Battle Royale? Yeah, sorry, I didn't know there was a manga.
No, I think the manga is the original.
I've read the book and I've seen the five.
Yeah, no, I think the manga's the original. It started out as a manga. Or it might have started out as a book. I'm not sure whether the book came first or the manga. But in the manga at the very least, yeah, that you know, it's the one person gets to walk out of it, and it's all televised, and it's put and people watch it, you know?
Yeah.
And then the kind of the tamer version of that sort of tamer is the Hunger Games.
I would disagree with that. I'd say they're completely different animals, but follow your thread.
Well, as in, like, sorry, they are pretty different, but as in the, it's this very, it's similar kind of the aesthetic of you get these children, basically, the young people, you put them, and they have to kill each other, and only one can leave, and it's televised. But then that gets taken a step further, and there was a little fantastic bit in the Hunger Games, which I thought was quite clever. Which is the kind of the weird double standard, where when it's kind of revealed, well, she's not, but you know, Peter says that that Katniss might be pregnant,
Yeah.
and everyone in the capital goes, oh my God, we can't possibly. That was very interesting, and I liked that because it had this whole play on you know, the abortion, on abortion, which is that no one batted an eyelid at these children being forced to murder one another on television, and yet the moment there was an unborn child, suddenly it was impossible, you know?
Yeah, that's not quite what I took away from it, but you know, it's text is always open to interpretation. Yeah, there is an element of that there.
What did you take away from it?
That was them quite cleverly gaming the system, in the sense of they're playing on sympathy. So people get more aid inside the Hunger Games if they actually manage to become popular. And what Peter and Katniss had done was become very popular. So making it seem like a tragedy, it wasn't ever going to be a gambit that would save them or save Katniss, but it might have got them more aid inside. Because what Snow was doing at that point was, you know, extremely suspicious in the sense of they shouldn't have ever had to go back into the arena again, but they were being sent anyway.
No, I agree with that. No, I don't think that's why Peter was doing it. It was just an interesting observation
Yeah.
whereby people suddenly, the line was drawn for a lot of people when they thought Katniss might be, and that was more shown in the movies than I think in the books.
Yeah, as an aside, definitely.
So yeah, no, I understand why Peter did it. Yeah, obviously, yeah, that was for, as you say, that was popularity. But it was interesting that as a, you know, that she decided to put that in as a writer, and the reactions to that. And the kind of also the blindness as well. There are a lot of different themes and a lot of different things you could draw on the Hunger Games. You know, I have my ups and downs about the Hunger Games, but there was some very clever writing in it as well, and some very clever imagery. And the whole commercialism behind it was definitely something that we could all associate with.
Yeah, definitely. In that respect, it's probably a bit more similar to The Running Man, which was originally a short story by Stephen King.
Yes. Now, that one is about a running... That's the running competition, isn't it? Or it's the...
Well, they're forced to run. You know, there's no choice in the matter.
Yeah.
And these things are sent after to kill them. And it is all televised. It's a game show.
Yeah. And it's the last... The one who wins gets pretty much everything they want.
Yeah.
But everyone else dies. If you fall behind, you die. Yeah. And yeah, it's a game show. It's filmed. It's televised. Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the first dystopian actually I ever came across, and it terrified me.
Yeah.
When I was little.
I have to say, it didn't resonate greatly with me because the trouble is I keep getting that and Logan's Run confused. For a start, Logan's Run is slightly different. It works on the premise that at age 30 everyone is executed because, you know, they're past it.
Christ.
So slightly different, but again, it's variations on a theme, really, isn't it? The first dystopian bit of fiction I came across was The Chrysalids by John Wyndham, whereby there's been some sort of global disaster, a lot of society's fragmented, and they've gone back to a sort of almost medieval state of living. Whereby there's a great deal of emphasis on living naturally, and there's a great deal of emphasis on the Christian church, and there's a bill of rights as to what sort of, you know, what people should be. And it literally goes like, and every man shall have one head, two arms, two hands, and lists everything down to, you know, fingers and toes. So something as small as having an extra toe could get you executed. Or could certainly get you sterilised and thrown out into the wilds, which is what happens to one of the main characters' friends.
What if you lose an arm or something like that?
That's slightly different. It's being born with an extra appendage or being born slightly different. I think the idea is that there's been some sort of nuclear holocaust, and obviously fallout from that would cause birth abnormalities.
Ah, right, got it.
But it's a very, very strict... You know, almost sort of totalitarian medieval type feeling.
Yeah.
And there is a difference among this group of teenagers, but the difference is the fact that they can speak mind to mind. So for a long time they can keep their abnormality hidden, and then one day it gets discovered, and they you know, they almost get hunted to the ends of the known earth at that point in time. But meanwhile in Australia there's an evolved society that's already like designing spaceships and whatnot, and they haven't had much to do with the rest of the world, and they actually come and rescue them because they're obviously advanced enough now that they can speak mind to mind that they should be with the people on the Australian continent.
Yeah.
So there's that. But no, it's a really interesting look, and it's quite frightening in the sense of it's the removal of rights. So any little difference, any little deviation in that society, you would not fare well if you did not have the required number of limbs. You would not fare well if you appeared to have any sort of disability, or if you had a different sexuality, and you would not, you know, you wouldn't be willing to be married off as a man to a woman or a woman to a man kind of thing. So, you know, in respect, both of us would be kind of screwed in that society.
Yeah, conformity. And it, again, you know, we mentioned the product of times, and, you know, it's interesting that in my lifetime I've seen kind of a whole bunch of different sort of dystopians arrive. And sort of the more recent one that, you know, you see a lot of is the commercialized murder pit. That's what I'll call it.
Well, yeah, I think that's a fair comment.
Commercialized murder pit. Where you've got big government and sort of taking advantage of people and forcing them to fight, basically. The next one is the environmental dystopia.
Yeah.
Where there's a tsunami or an earthquake or global warming finally takes its toll. And it's always America. All these dystopias happen in America. I can't imagine why. And they just wipe out everything.
Yes.
Just an wipe
that basically it's the sixth extinction.
Yeah, basically. And that, you know, that came at a time when global warming, the panic about global warming started to rise up. And there was more sort of publicity. We suddenly started getting all these films about the end of the world.
Yeah.
Then there was a brief period of endless zombie apocalypse.
Yes, that's the sixth extinction via disease, effectively.
Yeah, that was...
Which is the most likely, in a way.
Yeah, and that was disease, and it's like, oh yeah, it's caused by genetic testing or disease. And interestingly enough, if we look at sort of Frankenstein, I've mentioned this before, if we look at Frankenstein's a tiny, tiny sort of a little bit like a clip off of a dystopian, you know, again, that was a book which was very much about the fears of modern society and the fears of advancement and the fears of illness. So yeah, the sort of the zombie sort of thing came quite big again, probably around the time we just had mad cow disease. There'd been mad cow disease, there was swine flu, and
yeah, that was a couple of decades apart.
No, I know, but I'm just, you know, I'm talking about, you know what I mean, is that it was on people's minds. The, you know, illness was on people's mind.
Yeah, I would have said that in some ways that the AIDS epidemic was more of an influencer for the whole zombie apocalypse type thing.
Okay, yeah. No, I'm willing to believe that. Then what other kind of dystopians do we have? So we have Murder Pit, we have AIDS epidemic, and then we have the quiet government is controlling us, but most plebs are too dumb to realise, and then main character realises and finds themselves being hunted in a place where and always being watched.
Yeah, that's more of it's a false utopia, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that begs an interesting question, because if one that sort of spearheaded it, although most people would think of it as sci-fi more than dystopian, mm-hmm. is The Matrix. And when The Matrix came out, I don't think anyone had quite seen anything like it.
No.
But it does beg the question of, if you don't know that you're being controlled and you don't know that you're enslaved, are you actually free or are you actually enslaved? If, as far as you're aware, you have autonomy and you are making your own choices and you don't know that someone else is profiting from the labour that you're doing for them, or from, you know, from your own bioelectricity, as it turns out in The Matrix, are you actually free? Because let's be honest, when you leave The Matrix, things are pretty shit.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, you're being fed intravenously with tubes in The Matrix, but, you know, as far as you know, you could be having a steak and chips, you could be having a bowl of strawberries or a big slab of chocolate, because your brain is being told that's what you're having.
Exactly. And interestingly, you know, the bad guy in that, the guy who sort of betrays them, he just wants to go back into The Matrix.
Yeah, I mean, you can't explain to somebody inside The Matrix that that's what's on the outside, because as far as they're aware, it's real. It's only when they're taken out that they can see that it's not real, and it takes an adjustment period even then. So it's not like you can really offer someone a full and fully informed choice. So in some ways, you can kind of see where he's coming from. And I think what's interesting about it, and about a lot of the other false utopias, is the fact that how far are you willing to go to learn the actual truth, the real absolute truth? Would you prefer a comforting lie?
I think the truth is that a lot of people would prefer a comforting lie.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think that, you know, a lot of people, when bad things happen, and when you have tyrannical kind of governments, and when people sort of just try and get on with it, You know, some people go out and they try and stay informed and they get really, you know, they sacrifice their lives in many way, in many ways. But a majority of people have to take a step back, and there's a sense of preservation about that, which is that if you try and tackle the whole world, you're never going to manage it. So it's about choosing your battles, I guess, in many ways. But yeah, the ignorance is bliss. There's no doubt about that. Ignorance is bliss. And a lot of people do choose that.
Yeah. And I think that's where you get some interesting crossover with some of the more classic dystopian fiction, which, I mean, if we look at 1984, that is actually a false utopia.
Yeah.
And what I find interesting, and I've been reading a lot on this sort of non-fiction level recently, we're naturally programmed as humans to want more freedom. The reason we keep protesting and we keep campaigning for better rights for different groups of people, and the reason once we've achieved that we'll go on to campaign for something else, is we are programmed to want to be autonomous. We are
Yeah.
programmed to want freedom and to chafe against restriction. We're programmed to want to be connected with each other. So when you take something like 1984, where, or Brave New World, where you've got people who are grown in tanks, they're not socialized properly, there's no family unit. You know, love is forbidden because anything like that is would any sort of bond between people would challenge the status quo and the control that is held by those in charge, the totalitarian regime. Anything like that, it really is completely against our base level genetic programming. It might be more convenient for, say, the people who are in charge, the privileged few, but we would chafe under it. The reason the Matrix itself works, and they say this in the film, they made it basically a paradise initially, and they couldn't understand why the cells kept dying, why people kept dying. And that's because we are programmed to want to strive for something. And if we're not being stimulated in that way, we will literally just waste away. We think we want an easy life. Actually, we don't. We want a struggle that is just enough to challenge us, but not so bad that we want to like top ourselves to get away from it. So that's all really interesting, and I think that was incorporated in Orwell's 1984 to a greater extent. And it's very noticeable in the way he mislabels a lot of the systems. I mean, you've got like the Ministry of Love. The Ministry of Love aren't about love. They're the inner sanctum of this totalitarian dictatorship. And they're all about brainwashing and torturing people and making sure that the loyalty to Big Brother is enforced. It's horrific. And it's horrific that that's their understanding of what love actually is.
But it's also it's that is what love is. That is what love is. And then at the end, you know, the character turns around and says that I love Big Brother.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, that begs the question is what is his understanding of love at that point?
Because he's actually freed himself from a lot of brainwashing, and he's sort of reprogrammed, reconditioned himself in a lot of ways. And then the fact that even that small amount of freedom that he's clawed back for himself is taken away, that's the really heartbreaking bit about the end, I think. I have a quote here, which will lead on to hopefully a slightly lighter bit of discussion. It's from chapter 5 of 1984. It's like, you asked me once what was in room 101. I told you that you knew the answer already. Everyone knows it. The thing that is in room 101 is the worst thing in the world. Now, room 101 is basically the torture chamber in the basement of the Ministry of Love. And it is designed to break people down on a fundamental psychological level by making them encounter their worst fears, their worst phobias, their worst nightmares. So when we, I mean, we've there's a Room 101 program where people put things that they hate in Room 101, and the understanding is that, you know, that's it. It's been thrown into hell, and you need never encounter it. And I keep thinking, I would put kittens and, you know, marshmallows and stuff like that in Room 101. Because once I'm then reprogrammed, when someone sends me to Route 101, I don't have to deal with stuff I really don't like. So, What would be in your room 101? And I'm not building one, I promise.
See, like, part of me doesn't want to, you know, I'm not actually really going to tell you what would be in my room 101, just in case there's some crazy psychopath who happens to be listening to our podcast. He goes, ha, 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 I know now what to do.
I don't think Donald Trump is actually amongst our listeners.
Now, be careful.
I'm not going to be that careful. I think we should shoot Theresa May out of a cannon at him and hope they take out both.
Oh, Christ.
That's my opinion. But every time I see Theresa May and she's raising her hands and doing that smile she does, I just want to say, fly, my pretties, fly. It's just endlessly, endlessly caption it with that sort of thing. Anyway, my political opinions aside.
I need to think about a little bit more. What about you?
Slugs.
Slugs?
There would be slugs in my room 101.
Really?
I'm not frightened of them, but they just bring on this horrible sort of loathing. I can handle them if I have to, but ugh.
That's very interesting. So it would just be a room of slugs.
A room of slugs. Well, there might be other stuff in there. Stuff that I just... See, I've got a feeling that room 101 would be filled with this nebulous sense of fear, because I think the thing I'm most afraid of is actually being afraid of something.
Yeah.
and slugs.
Same question as what would your boggart be?
Yeah, I don't know, actually.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure it wouldn't be a slug. It would just be kind of like, you know, I might have to have 6 or 7 showers after handling a giant slug, but I can do it. I just don't want to. What else am I scared of? Properly scared of. What's my worst nightmare?
Zombies.
Yeah, but I think...
But you're not actually afraid of zombies, because you just continue to have zombie dreams.
It's the loathing, and I don't know, I'm sure that's my brain trying to work something out. If I ever find out what it is, I'll let you know. I don't know. Perhaps it might be going in and finding I couldn't read.
Oh, gosh.
That would be pretty bad.
Yeah.
If I couldn't read and I couldn't remember any stories at all, then I'd be really screwed. If I couldn't read and I could remember stories, then I'd be really upset, but I might be okay.
I guess cockroaches.
Yeah, they're not great.
No, I genuinely, I don't have a very good relationship with cockroaches.
Does anybody?
You know, I'm okay with spiders and snakes and pretty much anything like that. I'm pretty chill, to be honest. Well, my attitude toward most animals is just very much, that's great, you stay over there, I'll stay over here.
Leave it alone.
Just leave it alone. You let it do its thing, that's fine, okay? Like, I wouldn't go near a snake, because, you know, probably, you know, if the snake bit me, then fair enough. You know, I've bothered the snake. It's trying to do its own thing. Let the snake do what the snake wants to do. Let the spider do what the spider wants to do. I did get bitten by a spider recently, though, and that was not fun. In my defense, it crawled up my sleeve and I didn't know it was there. So I scared it and it scared me and it bit me and I put it out the window. I didn't squish it, even though it was a false widow and my arm hurt for 2 weeks. Anyway, but cockroaches make me shriek like nothing else will make me shriek. And they're okay if they're still, but if they're moving, man, that's it for me. Like, their little legs, cockroaches and millipedes and centipedes. I do not have time for that. So they would be in my room 101, definitely.
Creepy crawlies.
Yeah, the creepy crawlies. I would not be happy with that. What else would be in my room 101? You know, I guess solitary confinement, you know, strikes me as something which, just being alone in the dark.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, that's pretty scary.
But weirdly, if you wanted to torture me, you wouldn't put me alone in the dark. You would put me alone and then play music at me, because I think I can cope with a lot of pain, but I can't cope with sound.
Ah.
Which sounds really stupid, but, you know, that would, I'm pretty sure that would eventually break me, depending on what you played as well.
And I just love the music, same tune over and over again.
A constant, and I can cope with sleep deprivation, I know I can cope with a lot of those things, but that's just, I don't think so. I think because I'm so hypersensitized to light and sound because of my brain being a bit wonky, that would just be no. So my room 101 would be a loud room with bad music and slugs and this nebulous sense of fear. Non-distinct.
Yeah, I guess my room 101 would be trapped alone in the darkness and feeling something crawling over me. I would probably not like that very much. The thing is that, like, with cockroaches and stuff, you could just squish them. I guess eat them if you really needed to.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're not easy to squish, though, cockroaches.
No.
I mean, they probably would still be around at the end of the world.
Yeah. Ugh. Oh, just thinking about them. Ugh.
Yeah. There's got to be something. I'm trying to think of something a bit more concrete than this sort of, like,
nebulous.
nebulous, non-differentiated fear. Every time you walk into it, it's like, oh god, I'm scared, and I hate the fact I'm scared of something. I'm annoyed now. Oh, and I'm scared again.
But I think, you know, there's certain universal fears, like, you know, being, I don't know, operated on while you're awake. That's a pretty standard fear, I think, for a lot of people. Being buried alive is a pretty standard fear. Being chased by someone with a chainsaw.
Yeah, I'm just wired wrong, I think.
Yeah, you are.
I used to have a recurring dream about being buried alive, and
it's called trypophobia, I think.
Yeah, and then I decided that it was stupid, so every time I had the dream, I stopped the dream and started thinking my way out of it. Sometimes a wonky brain's actually quite handy. I was going to say, I used to have a recurring dream about drowning, you know, when I was very small.
Yeah.
And I got so fed up of it, I taught myself to swim. I didn't have the dream again after that.
That's cool.
And okay, this is a really, really silly recurring dream. I've had lots of recurring dreams. I used to dream that I was, this is again when I was very, very young, I'd be sat in the back of the car, and my dad would get out of the car, and then the car would start up by itself, and it would drive off with me in it, and it would go faster and faster and faster until it crashed, and then I'd wake up. And I kept having that dream. And Dad finally said, look, what is it that's upsetting you? And I said, well, I'm worried about the car going off without me. And instead of laughing at me, he said, well, you know how to stop the car, don't you? And showed me how to use the handbrake. And I never had the dream again. I was like 5 or 6.
That's brilliant.
So it's clearly my brain manifesting what ifs. And then once they're solved, it's like, okay, well, we won't bother you with that again. Doesn't need your attention anymore.
There you go. It's your brain literally teaching you how to survive. Clearly seeing premonitions of stuff that's about to happen, and then by dreaming about it, you prevent it from happening.
You need to learn to swim, you need to get on this.
I think we could both agree that our room 101s would probably contain fairies of some description. Nah, I got it in there.
Yeah, probably. Like, I don't know, Corrigans possibly. Corrigans anyway.
Yeah, they're not friendly. Being eaten alive is probably, again, a very valid fear that a lot of people would probably have.
Yeah, that wouldn't be great. I mean, at some point it would stop, though, wouldn't it? So
yeah.
It's how fatalistic can you be?
Yeah. I mean, but, like, what if they eat you from, like, the bottom up?
But at some point they're gonna run out. And at some point, you know, I think once they get to your stomach, you're probably going to die. So it's unpleasant for a bit.
Oh, it's just a bit unpleasant, you know.
Like, I'm the knight from the Holy Grail. She's a flesh wound.
She's a flesh wound, like...
Come back, I'll bite your kneecaps.
Like, yeah, it's a little bit more than unpleasant. It's, you know, horrific.
I'm not queuing up for it or anything. I just, like, it doesn't immediately spring to mind for sort of stuff that you're horrified that's a nightmare. Oh god, I know what it is. I know what my absolute fear is now.
Go on.
Having to watch someone else be tortured in my place.
Oh gosh. Oh Christ, yeah.
There you go, there's my big weakness. Empathetic suffering for someone else's pain.
Oh Christ, Christ, Christ.
Yeah, I would not be good with that. Depending on who it was. But I still probably wouldn't be good. I'd have to really think the other person was a complete waste of valuable oxygen. To not be bothered by that.
Oh, My problem is that I think we got asked this, you know, when I was at school, we were studying 1984, and they said, "Oh, what would be in your room 101?" And I was just there, like, everything. I'm afraid of everything. Like, most unpleasant things would be in my room. The worst thing, like, there are lots of things which I would deem the worst thing in the world. I mean, anything that causes inconvenience for me is in room 101.
Late buses and spicy food.
Yeah, basically. Is it inconvenient? Then it's room 101.
But all joking aside, having somebody hit you on a psychological level like that to break you down and reprogram you is actually, when you think about it properly, it's a really, really horrible, but probably horribly effective tool.
Well, yeah. I mentioned solitary confinement, and solitary confinement, a lot of people don't think it's actually that bad, but actually consistent solitary confinement really does send people crazy.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
It's an awful form of torture.
I mean, you're cutting off one of the three main things that we as human beings, as Homo sapiens, actually really need, and that's the relatedness. Even the most introverted, non-social and misanthropic of us actually need connection with someone or something.
Yeah. Or just a varied environment.
Yes.
You know, you can have hermits who just sort of seclude themselves from society entirely, but they need the freedom to be able to walk around and to sort of interact with their environment. So if you're in an environment which does not interact with you in any way, it can drive you crazy.
Yeah.
You know, you need engagement with your brain. And if that's taken away from you, then, you know, it's just the thought of it. And obviously, actually, that and the torture and the whole, the kind of the room 101 and the conditioning is something that I looked into, and, you know, sensory deprivation tanks and things along those lines was something I looked into a little bit for my writing as well. And as I said, I don't write dystopia. But I think that a lot of sort of fantasy and a lot of sci-fi have got dystopian qualities in them.
Yeah, definitely.
That's another thing. Old sci-fis, the old sci-fis movies, you know, the ones that were just despair incarnate.
Well, like at the end of the ones that sort of produced around the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s, and it was sort of a reflection of, you know, the state of deprivation and the disillusionment that came from the fact that, you know, we're in the middle of a Cold War. This is after the Second World War, and yet all of us, none of us can relax. Those who've got plenty are still really paranoid about people taking it. The people who haven't got plenty are actually living through this horrible beige stretched out existence. Yeah. And you're right, and you get to the end of one of those films, and it's like, and you know, the main character you've been rooting for all along suddenly finds out that they're not even human.
Yeah, they just leave you feeling a bit cold, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally agree with that. There's a morbid fascination for me there, but at the same time, it is horrible.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Dystopian situation where you think you probably wouldn't survive in that dystopian world. And the reason I'm asking is there's all sorts of jokes, like, I say jokes, there's these sort of jokey quizzes, how long would you survive in a zombie apocalypse? And it turns out I'd actually survive quite a long time.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Probably because I can be very, very practical when I need to be, not to mention ruthless. But there are dystopian situations where I don't think I'd survive very long, as in I think I would actually almost seek out a fight and, you know, get killed, because it would be preferable to dragging on my existence in that way.
Yeah.
For you?
Well, it would probably, you know, I'd probably die relatively quickly in a zombie apocalypse, I'm not gonna lie. I have pondered this probably more than most people. And I just remember visiting my grandparents' house, which is in the middle of nowhere in France, and it's big, it's a proper strong stone house, and all the windows have got shutters.
Cool.
And they have this cave under, I say a cave, it's called La Cave, it's a basement, which is cold, where they've got tons and tons of food. They just have obscene amounts of food in their house. Like, I'm not sure how good some of it is, but they just sort of hoard food. Like, it could last you for a while. And I just remember sort of looking around, and my brother and I, without even saying anything, we were both thinking the same thing, which is, this would be a good place to be in a zombie apocalypse. Like, you could haul out here for quite a while. And because it's in the middle of nowhere, you're not likely to have that many zombies kind of, you know, lumbering around. You know, I also think that a good place to be in a zombie apocalypse would be on the top of a mountain, because there aren't very likely to be very many zombies at the top of a mountain. There just aren't.
But no, you know? That's true.
So it's hard to get up there. You know. So Switzerland, place to be, zombie apocalypse.
But if we're going from an established dystopian world, so any film or whatever you like, what do you think you wouldn't survive very long in?
I saw clips of, again, because I avoid dystopian stuff because it terrifies me. I saw a bit of I Am Legend.
Yeah.
I would not survive in that place. Nope. I'd be dead super quick. Pretty much any zombie film, that's me. Like, I would not survive at all. Anything that would involve running for long periods of time, or meticulous kind of, like, organization, or really smart stuff. Like, if I was with a group, I could potentially survive. But, you know, anything that would involve me kind of having to, to be honest, I would not survive in pretty much any kind of apocalypse of those kinds of nature. So, apocalyptic world, I would not survive. What about you?
I would have said something that, I mean, I had to have to be quite specific, but I would, a lot of the themes that come up in young adult dystopian fiction now involves forced procreation.
Yeah.
But having said that, most of them have got an out, as in, there are people who escape, there's a way out. The one I'm thinking of is Only Ever Yours by Louise O'Neill, and I can't say I liked that book, but it did shine an interesting light on things. And girls are raised separately, they're no longer born naturally.
Right.
And they're basically groomed from childhood to be either wives, concubines, or, you know, to be part of the sisterhood that then raise the next generation, but very few ever get selected for that. So, you know, wife or prostitute, that's basically your choice. And there literally is no escape. That they're not taught to read, they're not given access to books, they're not taught anything except how to dress themselves, how to put on makeup, how to run a popularity contest, basically. And it is a scathing criticism on today's reality TV and the sort of vapid interest we've got in things like the Kardashians.
Yeah.
And it just you just think at some point the main character is going to improve. She's going to overcome her flaw and is going to make a break for it. It never happens. It's not just a case of she fails. The entire system fails her as well and has failed her from the beginning. There's no escape. The escape in the end is death. And I'm just thinking, yeah, I wouldn't survive very long in that one, because even without things like literature and even without the ability to read, I would not be able to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
My disgust and the fact that I will break out and probably throw my toys out the pram, really lose my shit over what my perceived notion of fairness is, even though I know things aren't fair and I understand that they're not fair. But when I see people could behave better towards each other, I'd be like, no, I think I'd take the whole argument and then the horrible death that then comes after it. I would not be able to keep myself together long enough to go through the whole thing and hope that I get selected as wife, because then at least I'm not being gang raped, you know?
Yeah. This is why it's just so depressing. Yeah.
That is a very, very depressing book. As you say, most dystopian fiction now does at least have a little gleam of hope in it.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I think it's depressing and rather telling that most dystopian fiction is not favourable to women.
No, it's very much, we must control the procreation aspect.
Yeah. Whereas I've yet to read a sort of dystopian which for me means that when people argue that, you know, oh, you know, everything's so PC, feminazi, blah, 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 you know, stuff like that. I say, but that's, you're not afraid, you're just inconvenienced, okay? Yeah. You're not afraid and you're just inconvenienced, because if there was a genuine fear in society of women taking over, if feminism was a general issue, it would be shown in the literature which is being produced. And people say, oh no, it wouldn't, because, you know, those kinds of people hold literature. Yeah, but literature is traditionally controlled by a very set amount, by a very set group of people.
Yeah.
And even though we're moving away from that, we still have, it's still dominated by white middle-class men.
Yeah.
Okay? So if it was a genuine fear that women were going to take over, that would be reflected in the horror we see, and it would be reflected in the way we depict dystopia, in that you'd have matriarchal societies who kind of pass around men. And to be honest, actually, that would make more sense, in that if there was a, you know, a problem, it would actually be about men, just like in the animal kingdom, you know, men being the ones who compete for women, rather than women being passed around.
Yeah.
Because that would actually be to the embetterment of human society, because it would be based on not who has riches and stuff like that, but who is able to attract a female, because they have the qualities that one would require to be able to provide healthy offspring.
And there is an interesting aside there, in the fact that we have had, I mean, it's ancient, but we have had matriarchal societies. We've had matriarchal theocracies and cults. For example, mm-hmm. the Turkish cult of Kabbalah, whereby if men wanted to join, they had to emasculate themselves first and become pseudo-women.
Yikes. But they got the choice to join. They weren't just told you have to join.
I don't know. I think there might have been some press ganging. It's not very well documented. It's something I'd like to do a bit more research into, actually. Not because I'm thinking of starting a cult, just because I'm interested. I think I'd be a very bad cult leader. But yeah, I mean, if you look at Stone Age art and things, it's very noticeable that you have the sacred feminine principle, but there isn't a corresponding sacred male principle from the same time. So a lot of theories lean towards the fact that societies during the Stone Age were probably largely matriarchal. Now, something like a big disaster, like the end of one ice age, the beginning of another one, a volcanic eruption, could have meant that we had to rely more on hunted animals for food, and quite possibly, because men obviously don't have babies, they probably did a greater share of the hunting once women got to childbearing age, because we just weren't fast enough to chase down deer and things. Not in the 9th month of pregnancy, at least.
No, yeah, no, I agree.
So it's a sheer practical consideration. So it might be at that point, and this is entirely speculation, but it's not just my speculation, that we shifted towards a more patriarchal society during a time of great environmental upheaval. And, you know, just because it works a lot better to have a matriarchal society in a time of plenty when you don't have to hunt as actively. So for a brief period, we probably did have a matriarchal society. And
yeah.
Then something happened, as I said, environmentally, and we had to rely more on hunters, more on men. Men gained more status in that respect. We don't know exactly how it worked, but I think it's an interesting thing to speculate on.
I wonder as well if it didn't work in that as we expanded and sort of different groups and societies began to pop up, the patriarchal side of things maybe started up when there was more kind of competition between two societies as well.
Yeah,
so it wasn't just that we needed to hunt, it was that we needed to hunt and we kind of needed to fight those guys over there.
Yes, we created a them and us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense as well. It's very noticeable if you dig back into any culture, mythology and, you know, god worship or goddess worship wise, it's noticeable that almost all the deities, the really powerful ones, are actually female principles. If you dig right down far enough, it's noticeable that the male principles come in and subjugate them a couple of thousand years later. So, you know, I know it's based largely on oral record, but oral record is actually fairly accurate. So, yeah, it is interesting, and now obviously it's being reflected in our tales, which are not oral now. Dystopian fiction, in the sense of, largely people who are different, who don't conform to this more patriarchal society, are being suppressed.
Yeah, Oh gosh, we're going down a rabbit hole now, though.
Yeah, we are going down a rabbit hole, and I think we better not go too much further down it because we're running out of time.
We are. Okay. Favorite dystopian.
Of all time.
Yeah.
That's really difficult because I like dystopian fiction. I do love the Chrysalids, and I do really like the Hunger Games. I can't say I appreciate things like The Handmaid's Tale and 1984 and Brave New World, but I can't say I loved them.
Yeah.
They're a bit like, in karate terms, when you get kicked in the head and it makes you better at blocking.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel about them.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. I think possibly, and I'm not sure whether it could be counted as a dystopian. I really enjoyed Animal Farm.
I'd count that as dystopian away. It's certainly got a lot of the dystopian feel to it, hasn't it?
Yeah. I enjoyed Animal Farm.
The number of times lately I've been saying, and they looked from the pigs to the men and the men to the pigs. That's come up a lot recently.
Ah, yes. Political climate. Yes. Another reason why I avoid dystopia. I just have to turn on the news to find that.
Yeah, it is feeling a little bit like that.
It is feeling a little bit dystopian, the kind of surveillance, the whole sort of thing. And then, you know, I think there are a lot of parallels which can be drawn between 1984 and sort of current and the world now. I think it's very easy to draw parallels.
Yeah. The control of information, I think, is probably the aspect in the outset that is actually the most terrifying.
Yeah.
Because when you remove anyone's right or ability to even acquire information, then you are basically putting them in a situation where they have to either believe or reject what you say. And then what's really telling is what you do with the people who reject what you say.
At the end of the day, I'm a utilitarian. Deep down, I'm a utilitarian, and I like the words of John Stuart Mill. I'm very much for his teachings, and the way I see it, everyone should have the freedom to do what they want as long as what they're doing does not impede on the freedom of other people to do similarly.
Yes.
That's the way I see it. And the moment where you can't do that is the moment that we have a bit of a problem. So all things should be questioned, all things, you know, should be analysed. And when freedom of the freedom to do that without it being slander is taken away, that's when you need to start considering whether we're going down the right path or not.
Yeah, always question.
Always question.
That's the thing that good literature, good speculative fiction will do, is it will teach you to ask questions. It will teach you how to think, not what to think.
Yeah.
And on that note,
we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.